Okay, well, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Scott Wolter as we talk about his work, his television show, America Unearthed. It's on tonight. It starts again, 9 o'clock Central Time on the Travel Channel. And we'll be back in a moment with your calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Our final hour here with Scott Wolter as we take phone calls. Again, his television program, Unearthed America. It's on the Travel Channel. It debuts again tonight at 9 o'clock Central Time. And how long is the show, Scott, each episode?
They're 1 hour.
1 hour.
1 hour running time, but actual air time, I think they're like 44 minutes.
Did you have fun doing it?
Oh, my gosh. I've had a wonderful time. The crew is great. You know, the production company's been great, and I love to travel, so I'm really, really fortunate to have this job.
Good luck. Let's hope the numbers are good and they renew and you just keep doing it.
Well, you know what? The reruns have been great, and I'm hoping it continues. We'll see how it goes. But you know what, George, if I could just tell you one thing real quick. My wife and I went to a baseball game 2 days ago. Our Minnesota Twins are playing great, and we decided to go to a game. And we went early to walk around and just sort of take in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Really good day we've had here in Minnesota. But a young girl came up to me, and she walked up. She must have been 12 or 13, and she said, "Are you Scott Wolter?" And I said, "Yes." And she started jumping up and down, and she said, "Oh, I love your show, and we watch it all the time." And then her father came up, and she had a couple of brothers and sisters, and he said, "You know, we all watch your show, and we really like it. And I have to tell you, because of your show, my daughter wants to become a geologist. She wants to be a scientist." And you know what, George? Whenever this ends, if that's what comes from this show, is that some young people have been inspired to become scientists, then it was all worth it.
Yep, absolutely. I lived in your neck of the woods in Eden Prairie for a year.
Oh, that's literally across the street from my house.
That's
funny. Remember Highway 101?
Yeah, absolutely.
I live on the west side, so I'm in Chanhassen. The other side of the street is Eden Prairie.
We were on the other side of the mall.
Oh,
that,
yeah.
That they had out there, and I was there. I worked at Channel 9 and Channel 5.
Oh, sure.
KTPA.
I remember, they're still around.
Yep, they are strong stations. Boy, did it get cold in those days.
Oh, my God.
Do they still plug their engine blocks in?
We get below zero and way below zero.
Freezing. Let's go to the calls. Let's go to Judy in Paducah, Kentucky, to get things started on the wild card line. Hi, Judy. Go ahead.
George, my friend. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
I have a question for your guest.
Okay.
You were speaking earlier of using the device of text messages as part of your production.
Right.
I have a request, and I have absolutely no idea if there's anything anybody can do about it. There's a movie that's relies heavily on text messages between this couple. I'm vision impaired, and while I can see the movie, I cannot read these text messages, so I'm missing a good part of the plot.
Judy, don't worry. I can't read them either. They are so small when the person's holding their phone. They're doing it as an effect, but I really can't see it either. Scott, what about you?
Well, you know, we don't rely on that too much, you know, but, you know, people will call me and you know, but if I'm calling, I will pick it up and I'll say hello and we'll have a conversation. So, you know, that you can hear. But as far as, you know, requiring people to read a bunch of stuff like text messages, we don't do it that often. In fact, it's pretty rare that we do, but I will note that when,
make sure, you know, it's a nice tight shot.
In the field, I'll say, hey, let's talk it out. Let's not have them read it.
That's right. And if you're going to read it, make it a real tight shot so you can read it.
Well, yeah, so you can actually see the words, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was so small in this Netflix series. You can't read it. It's more of an effect that, you know, somebody texts somebody and you know who it is. You could see the name, and that's about it. But
you infer the message, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Back to these Kensington rune stones now for a moment. Where are they right now? Where's the stone?
Great question. Well, the Kensington rune stone is in a museum 15 miles away from where it was discovered in Alexandria, Minnesota, at a place called the Runestone Museum. And it's a great museum. It presents the local Douglas County history, but front and center, the main attraction there is definitely the stone. There are other rune stones. The other ones are out on the East Coast. The Spirit Pond rune stones are at the Maine State Museum. And then the Narragansett rune stone is on a huge boulder that's on display outside in North Kingstown on the west side of Narragansett Bay.
Super. Let's go to Joe, Long Island, New York. Joseph, take it away.
Yeah, hi, Scott. A couple of questions. First, how did the Vikings' excursions into North America fit in with their overall scheme of travel, you know, being that they went to North Africa and places like that? And my second question would be on the Templars. Was there a specific question from the Bible that was unanswered to them, like the Book of Revelation or a mystery in the Bible that motivated them, or did the monks get visions and pass them through, or were there other concerns besides the spiritual that motivated them? And also, George, happy birthday to your mother. I guess she's 39 now.
Right? Yeah, well, that's right. She'll be on the show tonight, too.
So. Yeah, yeah. George said 39 every year after he was 39.
That's right. Go ahead, Scotty.
Well, first off, as far as the Vikings go, we know that they did some extensive travels and you know, both overland and by boat, of course. A lot of people don't realize that they traveled extensively overland and, you know, using the river systems and on foot in Europe and into into the east and all over. But as far as North America goes, we're really just now, you know, figuring out where they went and what they were doing. I mean, to say that we have, we know the extent of their travels here in North America is just simply not true. We know about Lonesome Meadows on the northern tip of Newfoundland was absolutely a place that they established a settlement. But the thinking is that it was really more just a stopping off point, a place once they got over here to sort of regroup and fix their boats and resupply for what I believe was heading south further into the northeastern area of what is now the United States and beyond, probably, but we just don't know the full extent of their travels yet. As far as the Templars, you know, there's a lot of debate about who they were and what they were really all about. One of the things that I discovered in reading my good friend Alan Butler's work was that the Templars, at least the leadership, wasn't necessarily the good Catholics that a lot of people think they were. In fact, they were anything but that. They actually embraced a different ideology, which I maintain was symbolized, amongst other things, by the hooked X symbol. And so they embraced a different theology of monotheistic dualism, a single deity that had feminine aspects. In fact, they dominantly believed over the masculine aspects of the Roman faith today that the sacred feminine was very important to the leadership of the Templars, and this impacted what they were doing quietly behind the scenes. And I think this was one of the things that ultimately the Roman Church figured out and was one of the reasons why they burned them. They were upset. And the whole idea of keep your friends close, your enemies closer, that's exactly what the Templars did. And when, you know, when 1307 came and they were rounded up, tortured and burned, That didn't happen to all of them. In fact, most of them were not affected by the Inquisition, and a good many of them made their way over here and left the Runestone to establish a sanctuary that would be free from the tyranny of the monarchs of Europe, the persecution of the Roman Church, and we now call that the United States of America, that was founded by a group of Freemasons.
That's right.
Founding fathers.
Did they know, did the Templars know where King Solomon's treasure might have been?
Absolutely. And I believe they brought it over here, and it was that treasure that funded the revolution.
That's interesting. Do you think there's anything left physically? Where is it?
Yes, I do, and I talk about that in my new book. The treasure, you know, that begs the question, what is the treasure? I mean, most people think of, you know, chests filled with gold and silver and jewels. But I think, well, part of the treasure did consist of gold and silver and jewels, but also artifacts, documents. Treasure can be technology, right? If you have an instrument that allows you to navigate and get across an ocean to a place that you want to go to, that's a pretty important thing. So treasure is a relative thing. And having said that, to answer your question, some of that treasure was in the form of documents. I also believe that they also brought over human remains. You can't use that as currency, but it would have been very, very important to them. The relics would have been important, certainly the historical documents. The question is, where are they now? And I answer that question in my new book.
Well, that would be a great discovery. I mean, great. Gina Maria in the state of Washington, west of the Rockies. Hi, Gina Maria.
Hi. Peace and love, and God bless everyone and everything everywhere, first of all.
You too. And get a little closer to your phone, okay?
Oh, okay. I'm right here.
That's a little better.
There you go.
So I have three small things to tell you. First of all, I have some optical calcite, or as Icelandic bar, which they use to help navigate ships.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear.
Yeah,
you.
We can't hear you, Tommy. See if you can get a better signal with Gina. That's the best we can do right now. Let's go to your neck of the woods. Pat's in Minneapolis. Go ahead, Pat. Welcome to the show.
Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was an Irish obstetrician or gynecologist or both, who lived in London for a long time.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And he was also, people say, a friend or acquaintance of H.H. Holmes, a serial killer here in the United States during the World's Fair. And my theory, all of a sudden, from 2 minutes ago, it hit me. They may have been more than friends and acquaintance. They may have been a sexual couple themselves, the two of them. That just hit me a moment ago. But anyway, my question is about a book by Michael Crichton. And I'm wondering if your guest, it's right up your alley if you've ever heard of it, The 13th Warrior. And now they changed the title some years ago to increase sales of the book. Now it's called Eaters of the Dead. But it starts out with the true account by Ibn Fadlan about the year 900, I'm sorry.
922.
1,000 years ago.
922 A.D.
Yeah. I wonder, what's your opinion of that? Because I accidentally picked it up at a library, and I'm fascinated. And sometimes I'm laughing out loud, and sometimes I'm horrified.
Well, I know the author, Michael Crichton, but I don't know this particular book. George, what's the basic story?
It has to do with an Arab courier back in 922 A.D., who accompanies a party of Viking warriors to the north. And, it talks about his life and everything else. But it may have been a blueprint for what really happened.
Well, I will tell you this. The Knights Templar certainly interacted with with Arabs, and the evidence is on the Kensington runestone. We talked about it earlier. There's pentadic numbers, which is an Arabic numbering system, but, you know, a lot like Freemasonry, where, you know, one of the things that, we just, you know, ask people to make a statement and a belief in a higher power, we don't care what you call it or who it is, just as long as you believe in a higher power, because in Freemasonry, we think that that higher power is the same for everybody, regardless of religion. So we have Muslims, we have Christians, we have Jews, we have Buddhists. We don't care. Native Americans take their obligation on an eagle feather. And this is a tradition of accepting all faiths and people of, different belief systems within Freemasonry. The Templars certainly interacted with Arabs in chapter when they weren't fighting. So could this have happened with the Vikings? Why not?
Absolutely. And Pat, brilliant to, even think of that book. That's superb.
Yeah,
let's go
good.
Back to Gina Maria. Tom says she's got a better signal.
Okay.
Go ahead, Gina Maria. Give it a try.
Okay. Can you hear me?
A little better.
Okay, good.
That's what I said last time, too.
Okay. So first of all, I just wanted to say that I have an optical calcite, Icelandic bar, that they would use to navigate the ship.
Yep.
Okay, and the second thing I wanted to say was I have a Knight Templar sword. It's not a recreation. It is an original, and it has a Fred J. Cronkite name on it. It's a ceremonial sword. And the third thing is I have found some treasures there. They would have made them out of mud, and they made them into, they were revering women and children, and they would have put them in the fire and made them into stones. And I have a bunch of those, too, and I wonder if you've heard of those.
Well, the first the Icelandic spar, yes, they use that. They call them sunstones, and they use those for navigation. They basically take the they polarize the light's rays coming through the clouds, and you can locate the sun in cloudy weather. So they would use that for navigation. As far as the Knights Templar sword, the Masonic Knights Templar. We use swords. I have one myself. And so the Masonic Knights Templar of the York Rite has been around for a couple of hundred years, and many people have find swords in the closet or in the attics that their fathers or grandfathers or great-grandfathers had when they were active in their orders. So it's not unusual to see those, and that's probably what she has. And then the third thing about making amulets or, you know, trinkets out of clay that they fired, you know, in fires or in ovens to make ceramic votive figures is a tradition that you find in many, many cultures. And, you know, I think the Vikings did it as well. So very interesting stuff. She's pretty well read.
She's right on. We're going to come back with Scott and take final phone calls in a moment. He's got a lot on his plate these days. His new book coming out in weeks called The Cryptic Code of the Templars in America. And his television show starts again tonight. America Unearthed on the Travel Channel, 9 o'clock Central Time. Give it a try and give it a whirl. There's going to be several episodes, and if it gets renewed, there'll be many, many more. So we'll be back in a moment with Scott Wolter on Coast to Coast AM. Don't forget to email me if you need to at george@coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, back with our final segment with Scott Wolter. Scott, are you going to have a little party tonight with the show or just going to watch it?
Well, Committee Films, the production company, is going to have a little gathering in the afternoon, and then my son and a couple of his friends and his fiance are coming over, and then just a couple of buddies. It's going to be a small gathering, and we're going to cross our fingers and watch the show.
Well, good. Excellent. And the first episode is what, the Vikings in the Desert?
Vikings in the Desert.
That'll be fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, if they find a ship in the desert, I want to know about that.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
Reminds me of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. That was a crazy movie. That was really good, though. Very well done.
Let's go to Michigan. Renee's with us. Hi, Renee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, George. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Okay.
Doing good.
Scott, I was wondering what you knew about the ruins and the mounds in eastern Oklahoma.
Oh, you're talking about the Huebner runestone. We did an episode where I looked at that. I actually spent quite a bit of time there. And if I were to put my money down right now, I would have to say that that is authentic. I think it, according to the runes, it dates back to around the 9th or 10th century, which would be Viking age. And it appears to say something to the effect of Glom's Valley, which would be a land claim that actually makes a lot of sense because it's at the headwaters of the river system that eventually flows into the Arkansas River and into the Mississippi. So similar to the runestone at the headwaters of a river system, it might be a Viking land claim.
Could be. Hey, thank you, Renee. Appreciate that. Scotty's in Tennessee. Go ahead, Scotty.
Hey, George. Longtime fan.
Thank you, sir.
Scott, same here. Congratulations on getting back on the air. Glad you're back. My question to Scott is, Heinrich Himmler sent people all over the world searching for relics and artifacts for the Nazis back in the 30s and 40s. And I've never heard anybody mention it, and I've never been able to find anything to read that he ever sent anybody to the States. And I was just curious if you've ever had anything that could lead you in that direction.
Good question. Did the Nazis ever come here, Scotty?
Well, I'm not sure I heard the question right. Did he say that the Nazis
traveled everywhere
for relics, but
yes,
they didn't go to North America?
Well, he's asking if they did.
Well, to my knowledge, they didn't, and the big reason, of course, was we were here, you know, and the American forces probably would have not looked too kindly on that, and, of course, they never got an opportunity because the way of World War II panned out. But did they think that some of those relics were here?
Maybe.
I'm sure they probably did. I've just never heard anything to that effect.
Remember the Indiana Jones movies, okay?
Yeah.
And the Nazis were always in those, looking for artifacts. Hitler, of course, a huge believer in the occult.
Yes, he was.
They wanted to find everything. They wanted the Ark of the Covenant, you name it. That's what they were after.
Well, you know, they believe that these relics held great power. And my understanding of the Ark of the Covenant is it was a power source. I mean, some people suggested that the Ark of the Covenant was fueled by powdered gold or monoatomic gold that had an endless source of energy, and that essentially the Ark was a battery used to power things like the pyramids. Now, I don't know if I buy into that or not. It's an interesting thesis, but the question then becomes, if it powered the pyramids, powered them to do what?
Exactly. Were they a beacon for something? Who knows what?
Or maybe some type of communication device for who knows who. I mean, I'm just saying.
Where could the Ark be? It could either be in that church in Ethiopia. They say it could be under the dome in Israel, in the old Jerusalem area. Who knows where it is, huh?
Let me throw this at you. What if the secret of the Ark of the Covenant wasn't necessarily where it was, but how to make one?
Well, that's true, too. The Bible comes pretty close to almost giving you a play-by-play schematic.
Well, there's some research that I talk about in my new book that suggests that there actually are instructions in how to make an Ark of the Covenant. So there isn't just one Ark. There might be many.
Let's go next. Whose turn is it? It is Jack in Abilene, Texas. Hi, Jack. Thank you.
Hello, George. Very privileged to be able to talk to you tonight, Scott. Approximately 10 years ago, my wife and I went to a area on the Clear Fork of the Brazos, north of our town. She found a round black object that was heavy, serrated edge, had a dimple in the middle, was verified by a local university here to be meteorite. But what is so fascinating to me about this particular rock is the size of the rock is about a 50-cent piece. The one side had a face on it. You could see the nostrils, teeth, the grooves in the teeth, although you'd have to have a magnifying glass to see it. On the other side, it had a skull where you saw the teeth, the absence of a nose, and still eye sockets. I showed it to a park ranger who has dealt in some things like that, and he said he thought it might be a Mayan key to a vault or something like that. Mayan ruins are not that far away as a crow flies from where we found this. This particular area, though, being on this Clear Park, was definitely a campground, and we found a right hind hoof of a miniature pony along with a lot of prehistoric tools, an undiscovered area, but very intricate carving on this particular piece. Meteorite is supposedly second hardest next to diamonds, and very fascinating with what it might mean. I was wondering if you had ever heard of anything like that before, and we would love to have you down this way to explore these areas that are really undiscovered.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating artifact, and if you wanted to send me some photographs of it, I would absolutely love it. Or if you want to send some to George, he could pass them along. I'm sure you'd want to see this thing too, wouldn't you, George?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I was going to say, Scott, is there a spot in the area that you haven't been that you'd like to go and investigate?
Oh my God, yes, all over the place. I mean, there are so many things that are out there, different sites, different artifacts, and not just in this country. I mean, I would love to do world unearths because there are mysteries and strange artifacts all over the world. It's not unique to North America by any means. So, if we're fortunate enough to do well this season, the possibilities are endless. Let's put it that way.
Jack, email me the information and we'll get it up to Scott. If you would just send it to George at coasttocoastam.com. And of course, you've got a couple websites yourself, Scott, don't you?
Yes, I do. If people are interested in getting any one of my signed books, they can go to my website, which is www.hookedx.com. That's HOOKEDX.com. Just the way it sounds. And if you want to read my blog and pass comments, I'm going to be posting blogs on every episode. I've got tonight's episode all keyed up, ready to go. Just go to scottwalteranswers.blogspot.com.
Interesting take. Well, that's fantastic work that you've been doing, Scott. Let's take some final calls here. We go next to Garrett in Northridge, California. First-time caller for him. Hi, Garrett.
Hey, George, how you doing?
Okay, thank you.
Hi, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for calling in.
So I wanted to share this story with you, George, for like the longest. A couple of years ago, I was listening to you interview someone who wrote a book called The Harvard Psychedelics Club.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm listening to this radio station. You know, I picked it up a couple of years before that. Love it. And I just had this overwhelming urge. It's like my first year in college. I'm sitting out front of my house because I can't play the radio in the house and I want to wake my mom up. And so I'm sitting in the car and I had this overwhelming urge to roll down the window. And I put my arm out the window and I kind of point my hand up at the sky. And I say out loud, I'm going to tell my mind, to tell my arm, to tell my hand to move the sky. And I just, like, the slightest little motion, maybe a couple inches, and a shooting star adjacent to where my hand is in the sky shoots across the sky. Like, I'm saying, like, you know, maybe a 2 or 3 second shooting star. And it was the most elating, you know, just so humbling. It was crazy. And I just have had this experience on my mind since then. I just wanted to call in and let you know and see what your thoughts might be.
Well, you've got the ability to draw, It's an incredible gift and power when you can do that. I don't know if that book, The Harvard Psychedelic Club, had anything to do with it, but you never know. Do you ever try to just do that, Scott? Look at the sky and try to summon up a UFO or something?
Well, you know, I haven't, but now that I heard that story, I may give it a try. I will say that I spend, you know, any time the sky is clear, I look up to see where the constellations are. And are you familiar with precession of the equinox?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Well, yeah, I think about that all the time, and I look up there, and what I do is sort of think back in time. How far back have people been looking up and seeing those same stars and studying them and you know, everything that people associate with the heavens? It really is humbling, and I think everybody should do it. It's very cathartic, and I don't know, it's just makes you feel good.
Indeed. Let's go to Ed in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hello, Ed. Thank you.
Yeah, George, I don't know how you do it. It's another great program, and you make the program yourself. You're such a great host, and he's even
thank you.
Asking you a question about that 922 book. So, you know, keep at it. You might have a future at this, George.
I just might. You never know.
But, Scott, I got a question. A gentleman I heard interviewed a year or two ago goes into some river in Texas and washes or swims. And he claimed that he started getting, when he was in the water, he started getting messages from aliens. Now, the message was they were the builders of the pyramid, and they're coming back in a date such and such, 2023. And also they told him if he would look at the pyramid at certain angles, there's certain things you could see that people hadn't noticed. Well, on Internet, I'm not great on computers, but if you go back 2012, NASA took a picture of the pyramid from up above. Also, he was told that the outline is ahead of an alien, and boy, it really is. There's two crossroads there that were old crossroads that are now highways with the eye and all that. But the sand had blown away from the base, and right there at the base of the pyramid when they built it, from the NASA photograph, you can see the date he was told, July whatever, 2023. So I had never heard of anything like this before, and I'm not good with computers, but somebody with a laptop, he said use a laptop, and they said they could see some of the stuff he talked about. I was just wondering if you'd heard anything about that.
Well, I have not heard anything about that, and, you know, I have to say, you know, I've been very fortunate to travel to many wonderful places in the world, but I have never been to Egypt, at least not yet. So, I mean, there are a million things that could be investigated there, and this is just another one of them. And, you know, whether aliens built the pyramids or not, I can't say, but they are eminently fascinating. They have been there a lot longer, I believe, than people think, and I think we're just really just tapping, scratching the surface of the mysteries and the information that they have to reveal.
Scott, I've got a minute left, but I'd love to ask you about this murder case you worked on in Vegas. Can you give us a quick synopsis?
Sure, sure. Yeah, that was an amazing case about a young female victim buried in a shallow grave, totally encased in concrete. And what they wanted me to do was to try to date the concrete using our forensic work to help them establish a time of death so they could identify this victim. When it all came down, we were able to nail it down. I said that she had been there between 1.5 and 2 years, and eventually they did figure out who it was, and they called me back and said that she was reported missing 1 year and 10 months from when they found her. And they said that they thought I'd want to know that, and I said to myself, my gosh, this stuff actually works. And it was nice to be able to, you know, to bring closure to that family. And I will tell you that it's still an open case. That guy is still out there, and I'm waiting for one more phone call.
Good luck on the show tonight, America Unearthed. Travel Channel, folks, give it a watch, 9 o'clock Central Time. Have some fun watching it. Thanks a lot, Scott. Keep in touch. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burrows, Tim Banal, and George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.